to a violent military and to an apartheid government is not a neutral act.
Gabriel, first, are you concerned about your job speaking out? Have the Palestinian Google workers, you said just in the last day, have come out? Have any come out publicly? Ariel is already out, but you still work there. And if you can talk more about specifically Project Nimbus and why this cloud computing contract is most alarming to you.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, there is definitely the possibility for retaliation, but I find a lot of strength and solidarity in my organizing connections with REL, with the union. We have a lot of support. And really, I feel like I have...
Ariel Korin and Gabriel Schubiner. I can tell you we have had so much trouble this morning. Our guests in the San Francisco studio, first we lost the audio, then we lost the video, then we got the audio up. You could hear the scratchiness of it, and now we have just lost the visual. We want to thank our guests for being with us, Ariel Korin, former marketing manager for Google Education and Alphabet Workers Union organizer. We also want to thank Gabriel Schubiner, who currently works at Google, speaking out, still as a worker there now, well, with Alphabet Workers Union organizing. They have taken on Project Nimbus, a project of Google, and it's Google's relationship with the state of Israel. That does it for our show. I should say also, you can sign up for our Daily News Digest email by texting Democracy Now, one word, to 66866 today. And you can watch and listen when you want to subscribe to our podcast in English and Spanish. You find them wherever you get your podcasts today. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening, a people and culture manager. Check the information at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder-Messiah-Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Werner, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Honey Masood, and Mary Conlon. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. On March 27th, 1961, nine black students from Tougaloo Southern Christian College stage a sit-in at Jackson, Mississippi's white-only public library. NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers, who would be slain 2 years later, prepped the youth for months to strike a blow against Jim Crow. This morning on Sojourner Truth, we present an hour-long special with Joseph Jackson Jr., one of the surviving members of the Tougaloo Nine, who has resettled in Southern California. He is in conversation with Orange County Weekly journalist and former KPFK radio producer and subversive historian Gabriel San Roman. Jackson recounts his role in the historic library sit-in and its aftermath. Jackson's story originally appeared on the cover of the OC Weekly in an article entitled Mississippi Learning. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Biden will be in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania today to push for a new ban on assault weapons, when he talks about his crime prevention plans. The White House said today's speech will also focus on the dangers of extremist violence in the country. Biden is expected to return to the key battleground state for a primetime Soul of the Nation speech Thursday in Philadelphia. Biden will talk about the dangers to democracy posed by political extremism. At a Democratic fundraiser last week in Maryland, Biden denounced the political ideology of former President Trump and his supporters as semi-fascist. Biden will return to the state on Labor Day for a speech in Pittsburgh on the dignity of the American worker. Ukraine says it's making advances in its counteroffensive against Russian forces in southern Ukraine. Meanwhile, a UN nuclear watchdog team has arrived in Kyiv and is preparing to safeguard the endangered Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant from a nuclear catastrophe. Feature Story News' Julia Chapman reports.
Ukraine says it has broken through Russian defenses in several sectors of the front line near Kherson. The city has been occupied by Moscow since the early days of the invasion. Russia claims it has inflicted heavy losses on Ukrainian forces involved in the counteroffensive. Retired British Air Force officer Sean Bell says the Kherson region is strategically vital.
It's a stepping stone if Russia wants to take Odessa, but it's also an important port with grain exports, it's got shipbuilding, and importantly, it provides the fresh water supplies for Crimea. And I think what President Zelensky is trying to do is ease pressure on the Donbass, where they've been fighting heroically but losing, and then start to actually seize the initiative. And I think Kherson is a great place to start.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Julia Chapman.
Meanwhile, EU ministers today debated ways to ramp up weapons production, boost military training for the Ukrainian armed forces, and inflict heavier costs on Russia. Among the economic costs could be a ban on Russian tourism to the European Union. Stuart Smith reports.
Estonia already prevents Russian citizens entering on tourist visas. Countries that border Russia have become the main point of entry for Russians, with direct flights from Russia to EU countries banned. While Russia's army is fighting in Ukraine, they say Russian tourists should not be enjoying EU hospitality. But German Chancellor Olaf Scholz opposes the ban, saying room needs to be provided for Russians to flee if they disagree with the government. For years, EU tourist visas have been used by journalists, academics and activists to escape Russia. One possible compromise under discussion is an exception for refugees, but that's been slammed by opposition activists in Russia as inadequate. Stuart Smith, Moscow.
Mississippi officials said today that residents of flood-ravaged Jackson will go without reliable drinking water for the indefinite future after flooding knocked out pumps at the main water treatment plant. That means the city's 180,000 residents will be relying on bottled water distribution and water tankers. The capital's water treatment system has been struggling with issues for years. The issues led to a boil water notice late last month. Governor Tate Reeves said the flooding sped up the inevitable.
There was a near certainty that Jackson would fail to produce running water sometime in the next several weeks or months. Unfortunately, that failure appears to have begun.
Reeves said the facility's main pumps were severely damaged recently, and the plant began operating on smaller backup pumps at about the same time the boil water notice was issued in late July. Meanwhile, Reeves said the state is working to distribute water to residents and advise them to not drink the running water, even when brushing their teeth. The city is also setting up water distribution sites. The Environmental Protection Agency has also identified concerns with the system, and in March 2020 issued a Safe Drinking Water Act emergency administrative order to address some of the issues. Advocates for low-income Nevada residents may say many older workers may be leaving money on the table because they don't know that they could qualify for certain lesser-known government benefits. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
People can search more than 2,000 programs free of charge on the website benefitscheckup.org, or they can call a national helpline. Simona Combi is with the National Council on Aging, which created the online tool.
Older adults usually don't think that they are eligible, or they don't even know about the benefits, or they don't know how to apply, and some benefits are complicated to apply for.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Gabriel San Roman interviewed Joseph Jackson Jr. in his Anaheim home on May 31st. We now bring the audio from their conversation to you, the Sojourner Truth listener.
Now, Mr. Jackson, before we get into the Tugulu 9 sit-in more than 50 years ago, I want to kind of get into your personal life a little bit. And you weren't born in Jackson, Mississippi. You were actually born in Memphis, Tennessee. So I'm just curious about your upbringing, racism, and other experiences that shaped your social justice outlook that ultimately motivated you to become a member of the Tugulu 9 and become a part of the civil rights movement and the history of that movement.
Thanks, Gabriel. My life really began with being born in Memphis, Tennessee, on April 14, 1937. Both of my parents were from Mississippi. They came to Memphis, Tennessee, in 1937. Growing up in Memphis, Tennessee at that time, you're not aware of the Jim Crow system that you grew up in, meaning only thing you remember is you're with people of your own race. You knew that you went to school, junior high school, elementary, with your classmates. You had your own barber shop, groceries, stores, churches. So it was a community that you grew up in. So you really didn't know that there was a difference in the races of the people until you noticed things were not what you had become accustomed to, meaning when you would go downtown, you would have to get on the bus, and when you got on the bus, then you automatically, I mean, you knew that you would have to go straight to the back. No questions asked, because you were socialized in this system, and it became a matter of habit. Then you noticed when you would go downtown that there were different water fountains. One said white, the other water fountain said colored. And this was the system that I grew up in that helped shape my growth and development. And I did not really realize that this system was known really as a Jim Crow system, and everything that we were taught in that Jim Crow system was that we as Negro people, we weren't called Negroes at that time, was that we were taught in our history books, we were told by our teachers that we were inferior than the white race. And due to the fact that you would always return back to your community, every time you would see a white person, somehow or another, it struck fear within your soul or your psyche, because you knew that that white person was superior than you. It was only until I went to Booker T. Washington High School when our English teacher told us over and over again that the white people may hate the color of our skin, but you get an education, and that is something that they will never ever be able to take away. And the thing that still I have a problem with, especially I know whenever I speak of this, when I was 10 years old, I believe, and I would go during the summer with my mother to visit my grandmother and my great-grandmother in Belzoni, Mississippi. I remembered one summer on our way from Belzoni, Mississippi, coming back to Memphis on the Greyhound bus, the midway stop between Belzoni, Mississippi and Memphis, Tennessee was called a city Clarksdale, Mississippi, and that would be the midway point where you would get off and you would go into the colored section for food and whatever. And on our way back to the bus, I don't know what was said, but the Greyhound bus driver, a big, burly, red-faced bus driver, all I saw was him hitting my mother in the face and knocking her down to the gravel road there. And when I ran to her, her mouth was bleeding. And that just really, really, really reinforced a certain amount of hatred for all white people at that age. And that pretty much added also to the hurt and the pain that I've suffered during those years when I was in school and in Memphis. And my mother, we got back on the Greyhound bus, and as usual, we went to the back. But after graduating from high school, I always remembered what my English teacher told me. And from then on, I vowed to challenge the Jim Crow system of segregation.
Now, you mentioned your teacher saying something that resonated with you in terms of getting an education, and that's something that can't ever be taken away. So that's a nice way to transition to you coming to Mississippi and enrolling in Tougaloo. So what brought you there to Tougaloo College, and how did you get involved with the school's NAACP chapter when you were a student?
I attribute going to Tougaloo to having become ordained after completing my freshman year at Arkansas A&M College in Pine Bluff. I was a minister of the Christian church denomination, the Disciples of Christ. At that time, I had a wife, Clara Wallace Jackson, and I had a daughter that was born there. And as I mentioned earlier, education really was something that I knew that I had to get. And I wrote the missionary board of the Disciple of Christ regarding a ministerial scholarship if I would be able to be awarded a ministerial scholarship to get on with my education. Well, fortunately, I was awarded a ministerial scholarship to Tougaloo Southern Christian College at that time. Now it's known as Tougaloo College. And I was awarded a ministerial scholarship. And that is what happened. I went to Tougaloo in the spring of 60. And I was awarded a musical scholarship. And so I attended Tougaloo Southern Christian College in the fall of 60. I did not know where Tougaloo was located. I didn't know anything about Tougaloo Southern Christian College. But when I arrived on that campus, I found out by Tougaloo Southern Christian College being a private Christian college, and I found out later that the black movement with regards to civil rights issues, this was the place that you wanted to be with regards to challenging the Jim Crow system. The State College, Jackson State College, could not participate in any kind of civil rights activities or demonstrations. So in the fall of 60, I found out that on the campus of Tougaloo College, they had a NAACP youth council there on the campus. I found out that this gentleman named, who was my mentor and my leader, Medgar Wiley Evers, always frequented Tougaloo College, and he always spoke there, and he lived in Jackson, Mississippi, and had become the national field secretary of the state. And so he was the one that called a meeting of those who were really interested in continuing to fight for the rights of our people against the Jim Crow system. And so we had a meeting. This was in September of 1960. The president, Reverend Otis Smith, which I found out from reading the book titled Heroes by Mrs. Merle Evers Williams and Dr. Manning Marble of Columbia University. I bought this book in 05, but I did not know really that Reverend Otis Smith at that time on September the 19th was due to be in court as a result of being involved in a Easter boycott of that spring of 1960. And it just so happened that they voted me. I was 23 years old, and the group of members of the youth council voted me to become president. And I had just gotten there. And that is how I ended up getting to Tougaloo and being involved in the demonstration. And that was the beginning of our meeting with Medgar. And Medgar would then, at that time, would begin formulating a plan, really, for us to go into the segregated all-white library.
Let me jump in here and just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Joseph Jackson Jr. Joseph Jackson Jr. is a living member of the Tougaloo Nine that did a sit-in at the Jackson Public Library on March 27th, 1961. And we're recounting that history. And I do want to segue into the sit-in. Tell our listeners more about how the actual planning of the Tougaloo Nine or the Jackson Public Library sit-in took place.
Well, actually, this was Medgar Evers' plan. From being there on the campus and getting to know Medgar, he was already a man, really, that was committed to bringing about integration in public facilities. He was about trying to integrate the public schools. He was also about trying to not only boycott the businesses in downtown Jackson, but he was also concerned about voters' rights. And so he had already established himself really as someone that appeared to have become a threat to the state of Mississippi, especially Jackson, which was the capital. And so when we met, he was the man, he was the one that decided to challenge the public segregated library system. And his plan was for us to go to our Negro library with the inferior books that was known that the George Washington Carver Library had. We had to choose books that we knew that the George Washington Carver Library did not have. All nine of us really did that. This was Medgar's plan. So when we would walk into the segregated white library, we knew that they had the books that we had chosen to check out from their library. We were told that, knowing that we would get arrested, none of us, knowing that if we were asked whose idea was it, or who planned this, who was your leader, we knew that we were not going to say Medgar Evers planned this. And that is how we were able to implement this plan, which really came from Medgar Evers. And we went into the library, and all nine of us, and it was an earth-shattering experience, because you knew that you were challenging the Jim Crow laws of the state of Mississippi by trying to break down these social barriers, and just the thought of entering that library, you really didn't have any time to dwell on being afraid in terms of what you had done. That came later, you know, when we were in the jail cells. But you know, when we walked into the library, I mean, you know, it was already quiet in the library, but I mean, it was like on the outside, on our way to the library, you know, we just felt normal. We just felt, you know what I mean, just like an average college student. But the moment we opened those doors, matter of fact, I saw a small clipping on one of the documentaries on TV, and that's the only video clip that I have. But it showed three of my colleagues, James, Sammy, Bradford, opening the door to the back entrance of the library, and letting Evelyn Pierce and Geraldine Edwards in. We, Abbott Lassiter, Alfred Cook, Meredith Anding, Janice Jackson, Ethel Sawyer, and myself, we entered into the front of the library. The moment we stepped in that library, all I know in terms of what I felt when I saw the expressions of those faces on those white people, I mean, it was a hush. I mean, just looking at the expression, they was frightened. They didn't know how to handle it other than to reach for the phone and to call the Jackson Police Department. As a matter of fact, to show you how nervous we were, Ethel Sawyer, I believe, when the police officers came to arrest us, I think she said, really, that she was glad that the police officer didn't look at the book that she was reading, because her book had been turned upside down. And then they came in and they asked us to leave. Chief Pierce and his police officers, they gathered around the various tables where we were sitting with our books that we had checked out from the library, and I think they asked us maybe about two or three times that this was an illegal assembly and that if we didn't disperse, we would be arrested. We didn't move, and then they asked us who was our leader. Well, we knew we weren't going to say Medgar Evers was our leader. We just said, we don't have a leader. Well, after that, they told us that we were under arrest for disturbing the peace. And they put us in the paddy wagon and took us to jail.
Did any of the, in the whites only part of the library, I'm wondering, like you said that people were frightened, so they didn't really say anything hateful towards you while you were there. How long was it before the police arrested you? Did the whole sit-in last? And then you said you're arrested for disturbing the peace. How long did the Jackson Police Department hold you? And then tell me about that time in jail for the period of time that you spent for the sit-in.
You know, when we entered that library, everyone really, for the most part, really were in a state of shock, because you have to remember that this was the first time in Jackson's history that Negroes really had ever entered their segregated all-white public library. And so when we walked in, no one came over to us, especially the white students, whoever were in there. No one, it was just, they were speechless. And they just couldn't believe what was happening. And with us, you know what I mean? Once we got our books, we just sat really, you know, steadfastly in the chairs and just was looking in the books, you know, and we didn't really have any idea in terms of how long we were there before the police officers came. That was not our focus. We knew that they were coming. I mean, but one of my colleagues said that really, while waiting for the police to get there. One of my colleagues said they were glad that they got there because that relieved the pressure on them. And I was glad that they came because just being there and knowing what you've just done and nobody is talking and it's just silence and everybody's waiting for the police to come to take you away, that is exactly what happened. No one said any racial slurs or any derogatory names at all. It was just that experience for both races. And so when they took us to jail now it was a different story because, I mean, here we are in the paddy wagon. And that's when, you know, your mind is telling you, now look what you've done. You know what's going to happen to you when they lock you up in those jails. That's what went through my mind. And, you know, I had a script. Matter of fact, when they put us in jail and they booked us and everything, at the beginning, they put four female ladies in one cell together and five of us in another cell. That was prior to booking us and prior to interrogating us regarding what we had done. So they, after they had booked us, then they separated us. And I was in the cell with Abbott Lassiter and Meredith Anding. And they put James Sammy Bradford and Alfred Cook in another cell. And I don't know about the females. I know they separated us. And then that's when they took each one of us at a time, the females and then the males at a time, and they interrogated us about, you know, why we did it, who was the leader, and et cetera. My thing was, we knew really that according to Medgar Evers, we knew that we would be released from jail. It was in the afternoon. Excuse me. We knew that with confidence that we would be released from jail at least about 7 or 7:30 that night. I think it was that Monday night, because the NAACP had posted bond with the Jackson Police Department. So we knew we were going to be out. Well, that did not happen. And the later it got, that was when I really became frightened. And my script was, if they came in there and got me, because knowing that system and reflecting back on Emmett Till and what happened to him and the historical history of lynching that's connected with Mississippi, the lady had got that night, I was in fear of my life. And my mind said, well, if they come for you, brother, you better have a script ready that may cause them or the Klan to change their minds about taking you out into a field and hanging you, because you know that's what they're going to do. And so my script was, if they came in to get me, I was going to fall on bended knees and plead with them, like, please, Mr. Klansman, don't hang me. I have a wife and two little children in Memphis, Tennessee, and if you release me this night, I promise you that I will never, ever come back here to Jackson, Mississippi and violate your Jim Crow laws. I think one of my colleagues said, well, that sounds very good, but you know what the Klansman would say? Nigger, you should have thought about that before you entered our segregated public library. I mean, that whole night went by, and the late it got, and then over into Tuesday morning, I mean, I was just really just frightened, just with fear. We were not released until later that Tuesday evening. Now, what was even more frightening, reading in the 2005 book titled The Hero, the writings, the speeches and the letters of Medgar Evers, I didn't know what time it was, because I knew it was a long time in jail. And I had just found out from reading Medgar's account of what happened. Sheriff Guilfoy, at that time, according to what was written in that book, had the bond money on Monday, but he refused to release us and made himself unavailable that Monday to prevent him from releasing us out on bond. And when I read that in 05, I said, that's what I was feeling, because sheriffs or those in law enforcement have been known and to leave the keys. They're in the jail for anybody, a mob, to come in. And I felt that, but I didn't find out why it took so long for us to have been released until I read that in that book. And when we were released, there was jubilation when we got back to the campus of Tougaloo. I mean, really, they called us the Mississippi Pioneers. Reverend John Mangrum, one of the professors of religion, who was our advisor of the NAACP Youth Council, called us pioneers, Mississippi pioneers. Everybody really was proud of our courage and our determination and just to be able to challenge the system. And so there again, you know, we've got to go to court on this matter. And that particular day when we were taken to Hines courthouse, I would say there were a large a crowd of Negroes just waving their hands and smiling and just so proud of us when we got out of the cars to go up the steps leading into the courthouse. I don't know what happened outside, but you know, I've always kept archival information of that incident, and I have an archival piece from the newspaper, the Jackson newspaper, called The Patriot. And the article, in bold letters, the topic was, Jackson reaches a turning point. And there were approximately 100 Negroes standing outside screaming. They were happy to see the students from Tougaloo enter into the courtroom. And further down, I read that the Jackson police officers were unable to really maintain control of that crowd. And, you know, we only know of the dogs, you know, that was biting the Negroes there in Birmingham. You know, that was on national TV, you know. But people don't know that they had German Shepherd dogs at that time in 1961, and some of our people were threatened to be bitten by these dogs, and my leader and my mentor was really caught in the midst of the riot to the point where he was hit over the head by a police officer with his pistol. And this was what was written in this archival newspaper. Well, when we entered into the courthouse facing the judge, judge told us that we were charged with disturbing the peace, all nine of us, and that we would be fined $100 each, provided that we would not participate in any other acts of civil disobedience. Because if we did, if we were involved, if we involved ourselves in future civil rights demonstration, then the suspended sentence would be rescinded, and the next step would be what happened to the Freedom Riders the following month when they rode into Jackson in May. We would be sent to Parchman State Penitentiary. We, of course, did not participate in any other civil rights demonstration. We had support from Jackson State College. I think it was about 15 college students rallied on our behalf. The college president told the students that Jackson State College was a state college and that it did not really want any of the students to be involved in going down to the courthouse or being involved in any kind of gathering. And I think about 15 of Jackson State College students disobeyed, and they went on down to the courthouse anyway. And as far as my knowledge is concerned, they were suspended. When we got back to the campus and everything, I finished my sophomore year there, of 1960, I returned back to the fall of 60, and I was a philosophy and religion major. And in the spring of 60, right at the end of the fall semester, when it was ending, my son, Joseph M. Jackson the third, was a year and 3 months old, became very, very ill. He had a very serious virus. My wife, Clara, wrote me a letter and said that she was really trying to make ends meet and trying to take care of the medical bills, but she no longer could hang on, and therefore I had to come home, had to come back to Memphis. And that's how it all ended for me at Tougaloo in the spring of 1962.
Now, I want to remind our listeners that I am speaking with Joseph Jackson Jr., one of the Tougaloo Nine, who sat in a segregated library, the Jackson Public Library, on March 27th, 1961. And we're here talking about that history. Now, it took until about the 50th anniversary, correct, of the sit-in itself before the historical significance of your own action came back into your life. So I want to ask about, why did that happen, that disconnect? So tell us about that, as, you know, winding down the story, how Tougaloo is finally coming back around again, not just in your life personally, but more people are going to learn about the sit-in, about what you did, and it's going to take on a second, it'll have a rebirth of history. So when did it start coming back, and how do you feel about its rebirth of history?
It would just so happen that I was watching a documentary called The Last White Night. And it was about my son. It was 2013, December. And my son said, "Daddy," he said, "there's a documentary of a man that's interviewing Byron D. Lebeckwith Jr. And he was involved in the Freedom Summer event. And he mentioned Medgar Evers. He said, "I don't know whether or not that show is going to re-air, but if it does, I'm going to record it for you." Well, this was like December of 2013. It re-aired. That was the last program that re-aired, I think, in January 2014, and it was at that time that I saw the annual Medgar Evers parade, and I said, "Oh, I've got to go to Jackson. I've got to really, really get this image out of my head, because when I left Tougaloo, I'm just aware of nothing but the segregated system, and I've got to really participate in my leader's parade." Well, that's how I found out about the Medgar Evers parade, and it was going to be on June 7th, that Saturday. Me and my son flew on United Airlines from California, and we arrived in Jackson, Mississippi, about 8 a.m. that morning. And here is really the clincher. We checked into the Holiday Inn Express Hotel, and that hotel is just about 5 minutes from the campus of Tougaloo College. And just knowing now, I was a part of seeing the changes that had taken place in Mississippi, to be able to live in an integrated hotel here on June 6th here in 2014, whereas I knew that 53 years prior, that was non-existent. And so on that Saturday, well, not only that, that Friday I met Charles Evers at his radio station, Medgar's oldest brother. He was 91 years old last year, God bless his soul. We went to the banquet, the Medgar Evers Foundation banquet that they give out scholarship. It was just so happened that Merle Evers Williams was there presenting an award to a prominent doctor who was a friend of Medgar's, and I saw Rena, Medgar's only daughter, there at the banquet. We took pictures and everything, and I'm sitting there at the table with four other ladies, and I'm sharing my history, and one of the ladies said, "Oh yes, I remember the trial, because I attended your trial on that day." And I said, "Oh wow." And so that was an unusual experience for me to be back. And then that Saturday, me and my son, we met there at Freedom Corner. Freedom Corner is an intersection of Martin Luther King Boulevard and Medgar Wiley Evers Avenue. They call that Freedom Corner. And me and my son, they have a statue of Medgar and Martin there, right there on Freedom Corner. And me and my son took pictures standing in front of it. And then we were in the parade. And so that's how I became reconnected with our history as being a part of the Tougaloo Nine. I don't know when the term Tougaloo Nine really was coined, but, you know, that's what we are called now. And so that was in June 6th and 7th, and the greatest honor that I could have ever received was when Debbie Fierce, through our email contact, who is the executive director of the Jackson Hines Library System, sent me a letter and sent letters to the other Tougaloo Nine, inviting us to attend a celebration of the Tougaloo Nine on August the 28th, 2014, and that we would receive a medallion with our names engraved on the back and with the emblem of the Jackson Hines County Library emblem on the front. And she said that we will also receive a DVD copy of the reenactment of our read-in demonstration being reenacted by nine of the young librarians, the aides who work for the library. They are going to reenact our demonstration, and we would have a DVD commemorating that event. Although I couldn't make it because, you know, I have glaucoma, and I wrote and told her, you know, the reason why I would be unable to make it, and she sent me my medallion and a copy of the DVD in the mail. And that's how I became connected again to the history of the Tougaloo Nine. I mean, it was you call it fate, the Zeitgeist, destiny, whatever you want to call it. All I know, you know, it happened, and then now here you are. You know what I mean? So I, you know, this is an awe-inspiring moment for me, and I, you know, I have no control over what really has transpired with regards to the history of the civil rights history of the Tougaloo Nine.
Well, on that note, thank you for your actions that day on March 27, 1961, and also thank you very much for sharing your story and your struggle with our listeners here today.
My pleasure.